Welcome to Optimizing, the podcast about leading Africa's digital future. I'm Professor Barry Dwolatsky.
And I'm Karen Gammy.
Season 2 has the theme, Receiving and Passing the Baton. We're in conversation with people who have shaped or will shape Africa's digital future. Each conversation draws on the metaphor of life as a relay race. Our guests will talk about how they received the baton, who and what influenced them as they started life's journey. We will then discuss their own journey, how they nurtured and grew the baton in their hands. Finally, we will ask them about what it is that they will pass on to the next generation of leaders and experts. Today we're joined by Sifiso Skenjana. Hi, Sifiso.
Good evening, Prof.
And my co-host, as always, is Karen Gammy. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Barry. Hi, Sifiso. It's really nice to chat to you.
So, Sifiso Skenjana is one of South Africa's top new economists. He is chief economist and thought leadership executive at IQ Business, which is the leading independent management consulting firm in South Africa. Prior to joining IQ Business, Sifiso founded and managed an economic research and strategy advisory company, and he's previously held roles in asset management, strategy, and management consulting. He has an MSc Finance from ESADE Business School in Spain, and is currently pursuing his PhD, focusing on development finance and economics. He is a columnist in Business Day, BIN24, Sunday Times, and is also a regular commentator on channels like ENCA, Newsroom Africa, Power FM, Kaya FM, and SAFM. So if you've read his stuff or heard him before, this is the man. Sifiso, as you know, we've structured these podcasts using the metaphor of a relay race. We ask our guests to talk about how they received the baton at the start of their life's race. And that's where I'd like to start today's conversation. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Karen Gammy, who is at the start of her professional career. Towards the end of our discussion today, I'll ask you about the baton or batons that you will pass on to Karen and her generation. So, if you can tell us a bit about your own life's journey, what and who motivated you while you were at school or at university thinking about the direction your life might take. And if you could also talk a bit about who your heroes and role models were at that very early stage of your life and your career.
Thanks, Barry. I think I would certainly start at a period where in my formative years, I certainly thought I would become a medical doctor. And at the time, if you had any academic capability, it was often suggested that you'd either become a lawyer or a doctor, and maybe an engineer. So it seemed that I had a bit of, a push and leanings towards medicine until, when I was in grade 11, we had then the opportunity of spending time with a seasoned professional in the area in which you wanted to grow professionally. And so I spent 3 weeks with a medical doctor. And one of the best things that happened during that period is that, during, I guess, the shadowing or internship, whichever way we would call it, she said, when she's at work, I'll be at work. And that meant that I was on call a couple of times a week into the wee hours of the night, and I wouldn't have any sleep like a normal doctor wouldn't. And what it truly did is that it gave me the real context of what that career entailed and whether or not it was truly something I wanted to explore. It was at that point in time that I realized that absolutely not. and I knew that I had to pivot. So again, you know, when you're in high school and you're finding yourself now pivoting at a critical turning point where you're about to get into university and now only you're actually realizing that you actually don't really know what you want. And at that point in time, I was fortunately quite decent with mathematics. And so a career in actuarial science actually became a little bit more interesting for me. And I had applied for that in a number of institutions across the country. And eventually, for some reason, I ended up choosing to do a business science which had an emphasis on finance and economics. At that point in time, I absolutely had no idea what it would actually inform from a career point of view, but they said if you're decent or pretty good at maths, it would also be one of the spaces that you'd find particularly interesting. And fast forward towards the end of my matric, I then started applying for scholarships. And lo and behold, one of the companies that I eventually earned a scholarship with was what was then BOE Trust, which is now under Nedbank. And of course, the space in which they're in is you know, asset management and investment management. And so then the fit was always then going to be quite natural in terms of having done or going into a degree, which is finance and economics, going into a firm whose focus is also in that space. And so I had the benefit then of every holiday from first year, actually, of doing VAC work at then BOE. And I think that's probably where I started cutting my teeth in understanding the industry and putting theory into life more real time. As every holiday I was always doing VAC work. And I think that's probably one of the first, I'd say, big benefits that I got, because I don't think many people have the benefit of getting to see the real world from a professional point of view as early as first year, and with the frequency and the cadence that I did. And by the time I was in third year, I'd you know, sporadically even go into office and watch the traders and understand how they were doing their trades, understand the systems that they were using, and, you know, you understand stop losses and margin calls, all of these things that would have been theoretical concepts when you're studying them at university. I started understanding them in real life while I was still at university. And so I think what that did, it really, I think, is sort of conditioning my mind around how I would participate as a professional when I'd finally graduate. And so 4 years later, I graduated at the University of Cape Town. And then I started going into the stockbroking space, where I started as a stockbroking administrator. And I guess that's where my earlier role models, you know, started showing up. There was a woman at BOE, I think she's still there, Shahida. I think she used to be Jacob's prior to being married. And she really, I think, started exposing me to a real and detailed, you know, stock research and understanding, you know, at the highest level what would be expected of an analyst. And she really pushed me quite a bit. And you know, through that, I certainly started understanding also the kind of quality that was expected at that level. And I think that's certainly, I'd say, call it the journey into the entry into my professional career, and from then, Prof, it's really taken some really interesting turns for sure.
Could we just go back a step and just to understand, where did you grow up and where did you go to school, in which part of the country?
So I was born in Johannesburg at Baragwanath Hospital. At the time, it was the world's biggest hospital, actually. But after that, we moved back to the Eastern Cape. So I was raised in Butterworth. And then from when I was 13, I earned a scholarship to St. Andrew's College in Grahamstown. And then I shipped off to boarding school in Grahamstown. And so I spent then the 5 years that would follow in the cold and the incredibly hot town of Grahamstown, which is now known as Makana. And following that, then, of course, then my journey, continued into Cape Town.
Yes,
where the weather is also pretty unpleasant at the best of times.
Absolutely. So it seems like I had the knack to follow the worst of the weather. I must say I'm pretty comfortable now in Johannesburg with very predictable weather. And that is less erratic for sure. So we don't live so much on the extremes. So I think in the later years now, I've become more of a middler as a person.
Yes.
So I'm enjoying life in the middle.
So just to kind of take it back to your academic journey. So I was reading somewhere that you're currently pursuing your PhD. Congratulations. That's a really big deal. But yeah, I know you studied you did your master's in finance at ESADE in Spain, which is really cool. But, how did you kind of land on economics as the discipline of choice to go for?
Sure. One of the things, Just before I left for Spain, actually maybe not even just before, so from about 2011, we had been exploring ways in which we could understand and enable financial sector development on the continent. And what we had realized is that ahead of, or at least following the financial crisis, a lot of the challenges investors, which was in essence capital investors, financial flows into the continent from an investment point of view, they had is that the funds that were on the continent had liquidity constraints. And so one of the things then I had tried to take on as a mammoth project from about 2011 for a good 3 years, where we had been market scouting. We had eventually even found a partner in Nigeria, was around how the question we're trying to solve was, how do you bring liquidity into stock exchanges and African stock exchanges in a way then that can enable the deepening of those exchanges? Because of course we know that as stock exchanges deepen, that tends to be followed by economic growth. And so development finance was something that followed me from an early age, and I can't explain to you what made me so passionate about development and particularly financial system development on the continent. But as I said, from an early age, I think I was about 23 already when I was trying to solve for this challenge in the marketplace. And so I'd started reaching up to some of my mentors and say, how do I break in? How do I solve this thing? And one of the things we had looked at is that because there's what we call exchange-traded funds, and the mechanism behind exchange-traded funds is that there's a market maker, and so the market maker actually creates liquidity on the back end of that. And so I thought that would be one of the interesting vehicles to look at implementing that into a number of the exchanges in a way in which then that could start to create a little bit of liquidity in those markets, because that would necessarily attract more pension fund assets as well as other kind of institutional assets. And so I think philosophically I was already ingrained in this idea of development as a study, and as a way of operating in the market. And so by the time I was at Stanlib, one of the interesting things that happened there as well is that we had to do some market entry work from an asset management point of view. So how do we break into these markets? How do we establish operations into those markets? And we're looking into the continent outside of South Africa. And so it was around consolidating our static operations, but also looking at opportunities into breaking into other markets. So we had to do deep dive into those markets and understand those markets in detail.
Yeah.
If you coupling that then with my journey going to Spain and doing my MSc in finance, I still had a number of modules in economics there, and econometrics as well. And so I never, I guess, call it let go of economics in my academic training. It's always been there. I just didn't practice it as intently as I find myself now. And so what happened post that is that I had been interviewing with some of the banks, and one of the global banks actually eventually made me an offer in Frankfurt. And what was quite interesting is that as I was mulling over this offer, and it was a global strategy role where you'd be based in Frankfurt for 40% of your working hour, working year, and 60% you'd be in the other global operation. I realized that a lot of these organizations, these multinational organizations, its primary focus was never Africa. And that in 5 years, I'd still come back to the same place of feeling like the energy and the passion around development for the continent that I had would still be a miss, despite whatever rich developed economy experience I would have received. And at that point in time, that's actually when I really pivoted into full-on development studies. And that's where the development economics and development finance for me became a meeting of worlds. And that centered, I guess, and started to anchor more emphasis in the work that I would do towards development studies, as well as then economics as a primary enabler of understanding development. And so upon coming back from my master's, then, I decided that I would certainly look at opportunities of establishing my own economic research and advisory work, where there'd be some work, of course, that focuses on strategy, over and above that would be understanding is that how can policy be an enabler for sustainable development. And so one of the major conversations that I started having, that eventually of course found itself even into parliamentary conversations, was around blended finance for emerging farmers. And so how do we understand ways in which we can make finance more attainable, funding development finance more attainable for emerging farmers? Because the challenge was that in its current format, the funding that is available for small and non-large scale commercial farmers was too onerous and too expensive, and so it wouldn't enable them to be able to access it and grow. And so one of the things that we were trying to put in place as a blended finance mechanism is that how do you blend DFI money, grant funding, as well as then this commercial oriented at money into a funding pool that is more patient capital and with less onerous repayment terms, that could inform how small scale, particularly black farmers, would be able to grow. And so that's when I'd say I really started getting, stuck into policy understanding, policy writing, policy advisory, and from there I'd say the rest is history.
So you can't see me, but I am like nodding my head emphatically, just like, yes, 1,000 times yes. These are all deeply, deeply important and meaningful things. And yeah.
And could I just pick up on this notion of development? And I'm very interested in a more sort of macro scale at how three things work together in the modern world. And that's technology, society, and economics. So the question is, where does the driving force come from? So people like me who've spent my life in technology sometimes believe that technology is the driving force. So new innovations happen and they drive change, which then impacts society and the economy. But some people, and I think sometimes me as well, kind of sees it the other way around. And we see they see the economy as the driving force. So the economy drives technological innovation. and that drives changes in society and development. In terms of the main drivers of change within the 21st century, and playing those three poles together, which do you see as the driving force? Is it technology? Is it economics? Or is it society or politics that drives everything?
That's such a layered question, Prof. I mean, I think I would approach it a little bit differently in the way in which I see the world. And it's inspired a lot by Nobel laureate Paul Romer in what he termed the endogenous growth theory. And simply, prior to his seminal work, we had Robert Solow, who had looked at what are the long-term determinants of growth, and he had looked at innovation as something that was exogenous to the system or to the development process. It was something that you put in, and that it wasn't an endogenously determined. And what was, I think, quite groundbreaking in how Paul Romer reimagined that was that human capital development informs also the pace at which you generate new ideas. It also informs the pace at which you can leverage capital stock to drive productivity growth, often what we call total factor productivity. Mm-hmm. And so the human is actually at the center of development. And I'll give you an example and say in South Africa, we have had economic growth between the periods of 2009 and 2017, but we did not have commensurate growth in employment. We did not have a commensurate growth in welfare. In fact, we've had poverty measures getting worse, inequality measures getting worse, crime measures getting worse. And so the idea that an economy can grow while the country is actually getting poorer is something we saw in South Africa because we failed to do the right and the adequate level of investment in human capital. And so for me, I think one of the biggest enablers for long-term sustainable growth and inclusive growth is the investment into human capital. And now the question is, how do you invest in human capital? One, the social investment in human capital, right? That goes into, I don't know, what is the quality of the social infrastructure in which those people live? Is it, you know, that talks to housing, it talks to nutrition, healthcare, education. But over and above that, then something more specific, which is the skills, right? And saying, are the skills that we're developing are relevant for the economy in the way in which it is able to compete in a global context, right? And one of the challenges we find in South Africa is that we've got a mismatch between the skills that are coming into the labor force as well as the skills that the economy needs, right? And so the economy is almost disillusioned to the skill supply that it's seeing. And therefore, for me, that's certainly probably the biggest risk to development is your lack of investment in people and also lack of a targeted investment in people. And I think that, for me, Prof, would probably where I would explore the nexus more curiously and not so much from a technology as a standalone potential driver or economy or politics.
So that's a really interesting point that you've raised, and I think I'm inclined to agree that of all the alternatives to like neoclassical growth theory, the endogenous growth theory is one of the more kind of like prolific and profound ones. And I know one of the biggest criticisms that comes out of this theory is that, you know, it's almost impossible to validate it with empirical evidence. And obviously there are ideas are around that and what you should do. But I'm curious to understand, like, from your perspective and given the work that you're doing and going to be doing, sort of what do you think is a good way of almost getting around that or making sense of that?
Well, I think now we are finding ourselves in a way in which it actually is validating itself, right? And so, some of the more emergent economists, Mariana Mazzucato, are asking interesting questions around, for example, is GDP a good measure of welfare?
Mm.
Or should we be looking at different measures that actually truly give you the true state of the economy? And also what's happened in the way in which we've seen the world evolving is that sustainability, which was often a grudge purchase from organizations in terms of just trying to embed sustainable practices in how they do now, started as this conversation of triple bottom line. Now it's actually embedded in operations because they understand the risk that it has for enterprise sustainability. And so a lot of these things that start to understand sustainability at the core, and unfortunately, when you think about what are the things that inform sustainability, that you can't ignore community. You can't
100%.
Ignore the development context of the people. Mm. And so the empirics are following piece of work, I think, in the way in which the world is showing us. So I think if anyone they just need to open their eyes and all the empirical evidence is in front of us around. And I'll make an example, and you look at one of the reasons the U.S. Remained a leading economy for many years until China recently took over. If you look at economies like South Korea, without much resource endowment, how they were able to become the size of the economies that they did. If you look at how some of the economies, even like China, how they started turning around, the biggest investment was into ideas, right? And so if you look at South Africa right now, our spend on GERD, which is the gross expenditure on research and development, we targeted at about 1.5% of GDP, and we're currently spending about 0.8% of GDP. In those economies, when they were investing into growth, that number was north of 5%. Israel, 10 years ago, was a drought-stricken country. And if you look at what their spend on R&D over that 10 year, it was also in excess on average of 5% that they were spending on idea generation. And now they are a water-abundant economy. And so it's an understanding that, the innovation process has got to also be embedded by skills and the investment process into humans. And so if those are not sufficient empirics for the validity and I guess the value that the thinking offers us, from this endogenous growth theory perspective in how we understand development and the process of development, and then I don't think we are paying enough attention.
I very much agree with you. I was in a bit of a heated discussion with someone who is very much anti-endogenous growth theory, and I was like, no, but you're not doing the right readings. So I 100% agree with you. So just maybe taking a step back and rather focusing on sort of like the work that you're currently doing, right? So you are the chief economist and thought leadership exec at IQ Business, right? What exactly does IQ Business do, and then what does your job entail?
So I think just to start from an IQ Business point of view, we are an independent management consulting firm founded in 1998, and we've grown to become the largest independent management consulting firm, South African born, of course. The other incumbents are foreign owned. And simply what we do is that we problem solve for clients. We help clients journey into solving for their client needs, right? And so that's in the simplest way. And the number of questions, of course, on the how, right, is that on the one side we can either, of course, give you the skills to help you on, you know, to help you understand how to solve your problem, or we actually framework the solution for you and we'll help you deliver that solution depending on whatever the need is. And so, you know, a bank, for example, can come and say, I've got a problem having a single view of my client. How would you guys enable me to understand how to integrate my system so that I can see my client better, so that I can service my client better? And that's just one of the examples. But I think at the core of it, right, it's about solutioning in a way that, you know, makes enterprises more sustainable, makes the economy more sustainable, and of course industries as a whole. So that, I think, as a business, what we're doing. What we've realized is that all of the work that you do in solutioning for clients has got to be grounded by deep knowledge of the content, right? And so you've got to be a thought leader in for you to truly understand the complexity of problem solving. And therefore, this is why research sits at the core, the nucleus of the business. So I look after the research function. And the research function, from that perspective, one, looks to say, how do we ensure that we not only know what we're talking about, but we're able to shape the way in which industry thinks about the changes that happen in the marketplace. Outside of that, then there's a question around how does the organization operate as a social citizen, right? Because we've got to create a conducive external environment for your internal environment to be conducive. And so there's a lot of work that we do in my research team that seeks to respond to this, to the challenges facing the economy, whether from a policy point of view and saying these are the policy frameworks that are potentially good frameworks to bring value into the economy. These parts of these policy frameworks will enable us to achieve the dreams that we want of an inclusive and a growing South African economy. So as a social citizen, then we respond to the needs of the economy and to be able to understand and help the economy understand how best they could journey forward, right? And so the many contributions, for example, I would have given around understanding how a universal basic income grant can be value-adding for the South African economy, or talking about details of the Copyright Amendment Bill and saying, when you've got challenges that could result in deprivation of intellectual property rights, how does that result in, how does that impact trade, for example? How does that impact sustainable development? These are all the things that we've got to respond to as people who are subject matter experts in policy. And so the second leg of the work that we do is what we call the growth portfolio, which really seeks to respond to the urgent needs of this economy's growth. The third leg of the work that we do then is certainly around truly trying to mark ourselves as a detailed and in-depth and a quality research house, right? And so we've done a lot of research, market research for a lot of organizations, depending on what their research needs were. And again, our approach is that, you know, we've always got to go three layers below the surface. And so if you see any research currently in the marketplace, you've got to get three levels below that level of granularity for you to truly be able to bring insights that matter for our clients. And so that's, I'd say, the portfolio really around of the kind of work that we do is really around, one, being an enabler internally for the work that we do in terms of servicing our client needs, and the other is responding to the country's challenges, and the other, of course, is helping industry grow through their needs for research, understanding their consumers better, or understanding how to go into new markets, what would be the opportunities in those new markets, etc. And so I'd say that's the trifecta of the work that we do, and the team that I lead at IQ Business.
And in fact, when we first met, we were working together on a task team that was looking at skills and skills in the future, IT skills for the future. And you've quite recently done some research on the topic of skills. Could you maybe talk a bit about this skills-related research that you've done?
Sure. And there's another task team that I've subsequently become quite busy on, and that's been looking at how do we energize through digital enablement post-economic recovery for the economy, and that was sponsored through the Department of Telecommunications and Digital Technologies as one of the ministerial task teams I sat on. But the research piece that you respond to, Prof, or you're addressing was one that was quite interesting for us. It's not often that, you know, when you're doing a piece of research, it teaches you as much as it ends up teaching other people. Mm. But the hypothesis there was that unemployment numbers, in the way in which we see them and we understand them, don't tell us anything around how do we need to respond, what kind of interventions do we need to put in place, and who do you target, right? It'll give you numbers and aggregates, right, to say, this is the unemployment figure for women, this is the unemployment figures for black people, this is the unemployment figure for young people. And so what we saw, and we sat and we had a brainstorming session as the team, and we said, actually, we have an analogy that we believe would be incredibly useful in understanding the skills complexity of our labor profile in South Africa. And we said, we'll use a commuter analogy. And we said there are four types of labor participants. The first is what we call the hitchhiker. And the hitchhiker is simply, if you just think about yourself, when you'd be hitchhiking, you'd stand on the side of the road, thumbs up, waiting for whatever vehicle that's going to go past to pick you up. Whether it's a truck, a taxi, a bucky, you'll get in just to get to the next destination that you need to get to. And that is very similar to the people that you see, for example, outside of a builder's warehouse, right? They are the hitchhikers in the labor market, in essence, is that you see how they, you know, they've got placards, a painter, tree feller, I mean, the plumber, all of that in one. They're just waiting for an opportunity, you know, to come on board. And then the second group within this commuter analogy, we said, is the train riders. And again, if you just think of the quintessential picture of metro rail in South Africa, particularly the ones here in Joburg, where people are hanging off on the side of the train as the train is going, it's that level full. But you also have an image around, if you slammed the brakes on that train, what would happen? You just have a mass of people falling off. And that's what you saw, for example, in some of the sectors like construction. Construction is in its ninth quarter of consecutive negative growth. And the amount of jobs that it has shed, I think over the last, year and a half to 2 years, is probably north of 500,000 jobs. I mean, I remember one quarter last year alone, they had shed 152,000 jobs. And so that's the quintessential image of these train riders is people in very employment dense sectors, even agriculture is one of them, where if a farm closes, you can imagine the impact it will have on part-time workers as well as full-time agricultural workers. And then we move on and we say, there's the bus riders, right? And so just to make a point also is that we track these guys around their occupation as well as their skill set. And so, from an education attainment point of view. And so you'd find that up to the train riders, most of those guys would have up to about a matric, and most of the hitchhikers would either have a matric or less than a matric. You get to the bus riders, and some of the guys with certificates, and you often see these guys working in call centers, for example. You see them working as clerks and sometimes receptionists, etc. So there's some skills profile building that's happening there. But it's still not at call it the highest echelon of education attainment in the context of the South African economy. And then the premium would be then the Uber riders, right? And that would make up in essence like 14% of our population that has some undergraduate qualification as well as ancillary certification on top of that. And from there, what our view then is that once we are able to start to look at labor participants in certain buckets, we can start to channel the interventions to the people who are most vulnerable at a particular point in time. And so we saw in COVID, for example, that the first people whose earnings left are the hitchhikers, right? I remember one of the analogies that came, and I think, Prof, you made the analogy. Actually, I think it was Prof Harun Burek from UCT, where even when these TERS UIF unemployment benefits came out, and they asked and said, you know, between a person who is just on a social grant in South Africa and a domestic worker who's now unable to operate in the houses, and of course they probably wouldn't have had any UIF benefit, who's poorer? And of course the domestic worker was poorer because they weren't even beneficiaries of grants, right? And so it's an understanding sometimes that it's not just by virtue of the fact that you're unemployed, for example, that a particular market impact will necessarily impact you the worst. The previous labor participants who were not grant recipients probably got the most hit at that point in time. And so this is why then it's so important to be able to locate the various labor participants and then target initiatives and interventions to the ones who become most vulnerable to whatever external shock or endogenous shock that results in them becoming in some form or another disenfranchised. And so this piece of research, over and above that, start to then bring in the context around, you know, trying to say let's kill the noise, that we often hear, right? And there are these zombie ideas that keep, you know, they get killed and they keep coming up. The first one is around the economy must grow, jobs will follow. Yet we had 13 years of jobless growth, right? The other zombie idea is that our labor laws in South Africa are too stringent, right? And you'd ask the very people who say it and say, well, how do you loosen them? What is strict about our labor laws, right? To the extent that they are inhibitors for sustainable development. And they say, no, it's hard to hire and fire people. Until then, you start to go to the institutions that study the labor dynamic in South Africa, and they'll tell you, I mean, the IMF, had interestingly, in 2007, started, or had been part of the wave of conversation that North Africa needs to loosen its labor laws. You know. And then by 2015, actually, they made a complete U-turn and said, actually, organized labor in South Africa has played such an important role in mitigating the extent to which inequality would have even gotten worse. Mm-hmm. To the extent that there's about a 20% wage premium for people who are unionized in South Africa. And of the people who work in private sector, only 25% of them are unionized. And when you look at inequality in South Africa, the largest driver of inequality is wage inequality. And so you start to see why it is so important to have organized labor in the way in which it operates. And yes, sometimes it gets, you know, blurs the political lines and all of that stuff. And of course, they can do better in terms of truly serving the labor force. But again, this is a zombie idea that organized labor in South Africa is an impediment for sustainable growth. And so these are all the things that in that report we're also doing, Prof, is that let's kill the zombie idea so that we actually truly understand the real labor issue in South Africa, so that we start to focus our energy on the right things and stop making noise about things that are actually not the real problems in trying to understand the complexity facing our economy. And so that was the piece of work around, you know, us understanding this labor impact report from a South African point of view. And we also were able to to do some modeling on their risk propensity given the lockdown stage. And say, if you work in this area, what's your risk of losing a job? What's your risk of being exposed with health risk? What's your, and so you start to understand that 50% of the people who are at most risk are hitchhikers. 20% is this group. And so again, that means that you can make informed choices around where you target your interventions. And so that's really what we aspire to achieve by the report. And we certainly hope that we can continue building on it in the way in which we bring insights around understanding the true complexity of our labor.
Yeah, and I think it was really fascinating work and really valuable. And it was one of those examples of killing off the zombie ideas, as you say. So putting some science and some data in place and kind of interpreting what's really there rather than perceptions and misconceptions. So yeah, it was really interesting work.
Agreed. So maybe just to sort of like pivot towards more of like the digital technology that's going to be playing a role in the next few years. So I think there's a statistic going around about like in the next 30 to 40 years, Africa's population is set to double, right? So between like 1 billion to about 2 billion. And given that, and also just sort of given sort of the frameworks that you've spoken to, how do you foresee digital tech playing a positive role in helping African countries kind of cope with this massive population growth?
Sure. I think there's certainly an opportunity to unlock different pockets of growth, right? I mean, the world had never imagined payments, for example, to be as big and as an emergent area of industry development until we started seeing mobile payments and the way in which they grew in Kenya. The world hadn't imagined microfinance in the way in which they were forced to imagine it until we saw the microfinance institution run by Prof. Yunus in Bangladesh. And often when there's challenge, I think there's real opportunity that also follows as well. And I think given a lot of the infrastructure constraints that sometimes technology can help to bypass, I think there's a lot of opportunity that technology advancement is going to bring into the continent, particularly to respond to some of the challenges, as I said, to infrastructure constraints. Like, for example, from a healthcare point of view, remote monitoring of patients. We know that patients have got better clinical outcomes when they were treated at home. But if you can have a device then that, you know, you can monitor their clinical outcomes, just because they can plug in a device, that means they don't have to go through 10, 15 kilometers just to get to a hospital or a clinic. It's the same thing with the opportunities education presents from a remote learning point of view where there's not the right kind of infrastructure or availability of skills. And so I think a lot of even the social investment opportunities for the continent are going to change materially because of what technology has got to offer. And it's certainly then going to bring this conversation that Prof and I have had before around the difference between digital skills and skills for a digital future, right? And understanding the nuances that come between those two. And again, you know, one of the things is that if we're going to continue to talk about the continent and its resource endowment. I mean, South Africa has got the largest deposits of platinum in the world, chrome, manganese, and mining operations now are leveraging IoT to minimize mining safety risks, leveraging IoT to look at seismic movements and all of those things to make sure that mines don't collapse, etc. So again, even in the way in which our economies are structured, technology is becoming an enabler for higher yields, better production, etc. I mean, I'll even make the example of urban farming, right? In South Africa, hops, for example, is farmed in George and you've got one harvesting season. But when you grow hops in an urban farming context, you've got yields and you can harvest three times a year at the right quality yield. And so I think technology in the way in which it's coming certainly presents a lot of opportunity for the continent. It doesn't mean that it doesn't, of course, threaten some livelihoods in certain ways, but I think there's certainly a positive opportunity that technology and technological developments can have on the continent, as long as, of course, we would do the little bit that we can to positively engage with those technological advancements and those technological changes. But I certainly see, I think, the continent as being a ripe continent for a new wave of technology-enabled growth. As I said, leveraging resource endowment, leveraging social investment and development opportunities, looking at agriculture, and other forms, I think, of industry development. As I mentioned, mobile payments, that we saw East Africa being the champion region for mobile payments developments and all of that stuff. And so I certainly do think that it is a continent to watch, given the pace of the technological advancements as well.
We kind of coming to the end of our time, but I just want to quickly touch on something that I guess we've got to touch on, and that's the post-COVID new reality that we're going to get into. And if there's one thing the pandemic has done, it's exposed the huge digital divide in South Africa and across Africa. And the question of how could we or should we address this digital divide and other forms of inequality? You spoke a bit previously about that. And I would like to just also tag on this big thought that I've been having about the future of jobs, because a job in my mind is attendance at work, and with the gig economy, which is gaining impetus through COVID-19, will there still be jobs, or will people do tasks on platforms? Can you just speak a bit about this new reality we're facing?
Sure. Which one to start with? Yeah, I think if we start with the latter and we say, what is the future of jobs? And I think it does actually have a very contextualized view on even our lenses of inequality in South Africa. Because just to very quickly give you a lens, if you just look at all of the startups that you see in the country, look at who's the founder and who they're backed by, and it's mostly young, white individuals in the economy because they've got social capital. And so as the economic marketplace is shifting, I suspect also there are other things that we're not seeing that are going to shift the reality around inequality in South Africa in the context of have and have not, and in the context of wealth creation. And that also speaks, so that speaks to the issues around, do we have equal opportunity in the economy as we know it right now? And so when we think about the gig economy and what it might do, right, and you might have seen landmark cases in the UK, and now it's gaining impetus in the US of Uber, or behind Uber, and the definition of employee in the context of that. And in essence, Uber drivers pretty much won the case that they've got an employee-employer relationship with Uber, and therefore they must benefit from, you know, the protections and the other, I guess, ancillary benefits that an employee would have as opposed to a contractor. And so this Uberization can have, particularly in an economy like ours, can have an effect that will exacerbate inequality because you remove the ability for people to become protected, the ability for people to get benefits, and you leave the relationship materially lopsided to the industry operators. And as we've seen even in the South African context, that private sector hasn't historically played well. I mean, you look at the gender pay disparity, right? Somewhere between 18% and 30% pay discrepancy across all levels. You look at the race pay disparity, you know, and so I think the Uberization, when we move into this gig economy, can also have an impact around exacerbating inequality in South Africa. And so I think even in embracing the change, I think, because you're correct, Prof, is that I think we are going to move to a space where we're doing tasks and not doing jobs. We've got to see that how does this contextualize to our economy? How do we embrace that change with a particular sober view of the developmental imperatives that live on the back end of that? And so we already heard when the president did his, I call it, second State of the Nation address a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things they spoke of, which was quite positive, was around the provision of some form of subsidies for data, subsidies for households to access a data up to some thresholds for free, right? I think that was a progressive start towards democratizing access from a data point of view. But I think there's certainly more that's got to be done around how do we get young people to participate in retail models of data provision, right? And say, get them to run these Wi-Fi hotspots in the gussies and all of this stuff, because they rely only on the backbone of the incumbent telecommunications providers. And so there's no competition really in enabling them to do that. And so I think the idea of the digital divide also got to be around enterprise development beyond just issues of education, saying, can you access a laptop where you are? Can you access internet where you are? Those are some of the drivers for the digital divide, for sure, but also the way in which enterprises and small and medium-sized businesses are able to gain opportunity sets in the marketplace from, I think, digital-enabled solutions has certainly got to be a focus point. One of the biggest risks to our fiscus is a shrinking tax base. To the extent that I'll make this very quick example, Prof. There were about 3.2 million registered companies with SIPSI, I think, in December 2019. And these were March reported numbers, I think, coming from SARS. Of those companies, there were 814,000 that were assessed for tax. There were 200,000 of those who had positive taxable income. And there were 380 companies who were attributable for 60% of the revenue basket coming from corporate income tax. Wow. 380 companies earning in excess or had taxable net income in excess of 200 million. So what that means is that when you've got big companies like that and one of them fails, the impact it has on your tax base, on households, and the economy is colossal. And so you've got to build in breadth in our tax base. And therefore, our focus absolutely has to be around how do we create a conducive environment for small and medium enterprises to grow and grow sustainably. In South Africa, the business re-entry, the enterprise re-entry rate, and so it's when an enterprise fails, and how many times do they go back to try to rebuild, is 1.1 times. In the US, the re-entry rate is 3.6 times. Wow. And therefore, it means that as you fail, you're picking up knowledge and you're picking up new lessons, and eventually you'll become a sustainable enterprise. And so patient capital, so impact investing, is going to be a critical enabler, for example, for SME development in South Africa, particularly also then saying, how does that contextualize to a digitally intensifying economic marketplace? So these are some of the things that we've got to be thinking around when we're actually talking about the post-COVID economy and the new reality, and is that our new reality has certainly got to be focusing on human capital development. Our new reality has got to be focusing on creating conducive spaces for enterprise development to happen sustainably.
Yeah, couldn't agree more, absolutely.
So as I think Prof mentioned earlier, I'm in the data science team at ABSA, and like one of the big sort of things that are going on at the moment is like everyone should study AI and everyone should study computer science or software engineering or whatever. And basically, if you have a small child, you should enroll them in coding courses sooner rather than later. So I sort of have my own opinions on that. But I guess, you know, very sort of like STEM heavy degrees have been kind of like pushed forward as the degrees to be studying in order to be future fit. And given that you are a professional economist, do you think that like younger people should be studying economics as a kind of job for the future?
Very short answer, absolutely. My supervisor, Professor Biekbe, said to me, "Sviso, in a good market, people need specialists. In a bad market, people need specialists even more." Mm. And given the complexity, I think, of development as an area of study, whether it's happening at a macro level or at a micro level, we need deep specialists in those areas to be able to truly understand what are the things that are going to be real enablers for growth. And so I think my profession, I think, will remain relevant for many years to come, primarily because of its focus on being an enabler for understanding how to grow or mechanisms of growth, right? Because growth is always going to be a question. Right, and so I certainly think that there's a lot of scope for development in our economy, for economists, but even in a global context. And as I was saying, you know, you've got emergent thought, high level thought leaders like Mariana Mazzucato who are forcing us to ask different questions around this area, and saying, you know, where's the value part in the equation? You know, and how do we bring value at the center of all of the planning and all of the choices that we're making from a policy design point of view to enterprise enablement and development. And so I think the profession itself is, I think, is rich with opportunities right now, and it's rich with also opportunities of innovation. I mean, the way in which the scholarly process used to work within the economics realm has changed, right? You first had to appreciate everyone's ideas and only challenge thinking along the fringes, right? And now there's impetus for you to go right for the jugular and say, actually, this can't be the way in which we do things anymore, because these are the merits of my argumentation. And we find ourselves getting closer to what we call true engaged scholarship, and we're seeing a lot more of that in our area of study, which is incredibly important. So I think there's certainly more scope for the innovative economists to come in and for them to also understand what are the economics of change and how do those inform how we need to organize society. And so I think there's absolutely scope for growth for anyone who's interested in exploring economics.
Well, you've certainly convinced me. I'm kind of a bit late in my life to change career.
Never too late.
Kieran's age, I'd be seriously looking.
That's fine. I'll take up economics and you can live vicariously through me.
Sounds like you're already taking up economics, Kieran.
So it's clear that a conversation like this, and we've just scratched the surface, I think, and it kind of shows how important all these connections are, and it's been an amazing discussion. So thank you so much. And just briefly before we let you go, Sophie, so could you just maybe talk about, and we'll come back to life as a relay race. And could you just talk for a few minutes about what advice you would give? And you've given, we've heard, become an economist. But the kind of advice you would give to a young person like Kieran, beginning kind of her life's journey, and what sort of advice would you give someone? And I know you've still got a long way to go before you really do hand over the baton, but I think you've got a lot of wisdom already accumulated. So what would you advise Karen and her generation?
No, thanks, Prof. I think the professional of the future is the person who understands contribution better than extraction. We've had
that's a good one.
Context.
Yeah.
We've had an economic context where you go to work to extract a salary and to go look at other things about your life. And the way in which even, you know, the ideas around the gig economy and all of that, what they are requiring more from us is solutioning. They're requiring us to give. They are requiring us to be net contributors to the spaces we occupy. And so as you sit and you think as a young person right now and you say, I want to grow, and ask yourself this question, is that how are your ambitions going to shape the way industry works? How are they going to change the way society operates? Because that's the person who's going to be the next leading professional, because they've invested themselves in giving and not so much extraction. And I think that as a landing philosophy, I think will put a lot of young professionals in good stead to grow sustainably in this ever-changing marketplace.
Thank you so much. And I think that's really, really wise advice, and I hope people are listening. So thank you, Sifiso. Thanks for being part of this. And I'm kind of watching you and waiting to see how you develop into one of our superstars in the world of economics. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was such a good chat.
No, thank you, Karen, and thank you, Barry.
This podcast is a Grand Geeks production. It is produced by Professor Barry Dwolatsky and edited by Evan Wigdorowicz. It is presented by Professor Barry Dwolatsky and Karen Gammy. Music is done by Callum Cool and logo designed by Evan Wigdorowicz. The companion website is at www.softwareengineer.org.za.